Welcome to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Radio, licensed in Bella Vista, California, and transmitting from Round Mountain. Here, we explore the lives of triumphant humans who endure life's persistent challenges. They all come from walks of life resembling lives like you, our listener. Our guests are driven by passion and inspiration and live with a compelling sense of purpose. Their persistence, perseverance are many times brought on by tragic episodes or by wonderfully cradled lives. But for whatever reasons, guests will openly share their innermost feelings and beliefs that fuel their works. With this determination, courage, and insistence, they are driven to put more into life than they take out. Please listen to how these inspirational stories may be closely related to your own. And yes, I am Henry Cuenca. Our guest today has set a meteoric flash through the heavens in working with troubled youth. Her behavioral education program is focused on work with children who lie, cheat, steal, argue, and employ physical violence. Our guests, aside from catching children who have fallen on drugs and other addictions, is marvelously unique in many ways. As she walks everywhere, she is a dancer, a singer, a guitar player, and writes and recites poetry. Could it be that because she has endured a fractured and unhappy childhood within a structured Quaker upbringing, or her grandparents' positive influence binding her gap of fantasy of having a father that cared for her? For whatever reason, I am sure you will enjoy listening to her heartfelt life and the profound epiphany that set the course of her life so beautifully, and the ensuing touching of countless lives of others. With the greatest pleasure, I welcome and introduce you, Sarah Clark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good morning, Henry.
Thank you. Well, it's certainly something that I've been looking forward to, Sarah, to have you on our show. And I'm thinking, why don't we start out and give us an overview of your program, Finding a Hero, and your work in behavior education?
Well, I work 2 days a week. I volunteer at an elementary school, and I work with students who have serious behavior problems. And the program is rather simple. I arrive at a recess, I already know the children I'm going to work with. The children are selected in first grade, so the most difficult child in the first grade is usually the one I get. I will stay with that child then for 6 years.
My goodness.
Twice a week for 6 years, from October through May, mm-hmm. I will show up at a recess. And first through third grade, I will ask the teacher, has this child's behavior been acceptable to you in the preceding period, not day, week, or month, but just the preceding period? And they will say yes or no. If they say yes, the child's behavior has been acceptable, I say, okay, now I need 3 things that the child did that was acceptable. And so the teacher can tell me one, the child can tell me one, another kid can tell me, but I got 3 things I got to write down. So, oh, he picked up my pencil for me. He finished his math. He whatever. But I need 3. I write them down on a calendar. That's very important because with children who have behavior problems, that's what everybody sees.
You know, I said some pretty hard words in the opening with the type of student that you're working with. who is this concept developed by?
The concept, the theoretical foundation for it is mostly choice theory, reality therapy, developed by Bill Glasser, with a little bit of Boys Town thrown in.
Mm-hmm. And how were you introduced to this program?
Well, I was introduced to choice theory, reality therapy when I had the blessing of being hired as a teacher at community day school.
Mm-hmm.
That was such a blessing. I cried every day for a year. That is not an exaggeration. It was extremely difficult, even if you only had a few children, because when you put the few children who have serious behavior problems together with no other kids, then it is extremely difficult. So we had a superintendent at that time whose office was down the hall, and I would hear him whistling. Well, if anybody's job was more challenging than mine, it was being a superintendent of a school district. So how he could whistle, I didn't know. So I ran down to his office one day, on the verge of tears, of course, and he was trained in choice theory reality therapy.
And so, he started teaching me. How are the candidates or children or kids that that you teach, how are they assembled? I mean, how do you know, what are the manifestations that come up that hit your radar where makes them potential students of your behavioral class?
They don't hit my radar. They hit the administrators and the teachers' radar.
The teachers. Uh-huh.
And so all I say is, I want your most challenging kid. So if you have, I just want the biggest behavior problem you have. That's what I want. You know, I do Sudoku. I do black belt Sudoku. I want the black belt kid. I want the one that's going to be super hard. And so they pick it. I never select the kid. They select the kid.
And they bring them to you.
No, I go to the classroom, right. When we begin, we have a whole meeting with the parents. I will not work without parent approval.
Mm-hmm.
I won't. So the parent needs to agree. So it's usually the teacher calls the parent, says, here's this program. Would you like it for your kid? Mm-hmm. If the parent says yes, we all meet, the administrator, the teacher, the kid, me. I run down what I'm going to do. If they want me to do it, I do it. And I also tell them that at any time, I tell the parent and teachers also, at any time, especially the parent, would not want me to work with a child, I'll stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't say, oh, why?
What is generally the dynamics of a household of a student that finds their way into your program?
It's across the board. However, the hero I'm looking for in my program, the hero that I'm looking for is the one who has suffered with injustices in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because the students I work with, not all of them, they're all different kinds, but many of them are angry and they love a fight. They enjoy it. And they're not easily intimidated. If in first grade you will stand up to your teacher and the yard duties, you're not easily intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I want is students who have suffered poverty, influence of drugs, you name it.
Alcoholism, I'm sure.
Yeah, you name it. Violence,
dysfunctional
whatever.
Families, essentially, huh?
Right.
Do you receive support from the families of these students?
It's really a beautiful thing. What I do is, you know, education is compulsory. My program is not compulsory. So they have to say yes. So I receive support in different ways. I don't count on support. Those families are doing the best they can with what they have. So I'm not asking them, oh, would you please do this or would you please do that? Whatever they can do, they can do. But what I'm going to do is care about their child.
Right.
That's what
obviously
I'm going to do.
To that.
And I'm going to call them every month. Excuse me. And actually, I have fallen behind on that. Ideally, I call them every month and said, this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
but I don't never ask them to do anything. If they want to do something, that's fine. If they don't,
Sarah, why do you do this?
Why do I do this? Now, this is what
not because of contribution to your 401k, I'm sure.
No. I do this. And you're asking the question, I have to say, that my sixth grader started asking me and hasn't shut up yet. He started in second grade. Why do you do this? Well, I didn't know how to answer. I said, well, because I feel like it. I said, do they pay you? I said, no, nobody pays me. Well, does the principal know you're here? Yeah, she knows I'm here. Well, how do you get money? So now by sixth grade, he knows how retirement systems work. He knows about taxation, paying into. He's really informed now. And he started this just the other day, too. So your question is, why do I do it? Well, I already said I'm trying to find these heroes. I'm not a fighter. I'm not an activist.
But you are persistent.
I study Japanese, and there's a Japanese proverb that goes, Keizoku wo chikaranari. That's two characters. The first one is for persistence, and the second one is for power. Persistence is power, and that I am.
So that's what you bring to the – one of the components that you bring to the table is you won't give up.
Never.
Can you tell us of some of your successes?
I'll tell you my successes with kids and parents. Successes with kids is so we had this one guy, and he's a wild man in first grade. So the deal there was he would run. Like, oh, it's time to line up. So he'd start running, had a dead run, knock two people down, elbow three, kick four, and get to the front of the line. And when the teacher found a problem with that, he'd say, I didn't do anything. I just lined up. So anyway, he was pretty much a wild man. Now, in sixth grade, it's so moving. The story is too long to tell, but basically, he can have his wild friends. And he can separate from them. And there was an issue where they were all going wild in the cafeteria. And the adult in there said she wanted to talk about it. Nobody would talk about it. They all kept doing their wild thing. And my guy separated and said, I'd like to talk about it.
Success. Bingo.
That's power.
Well, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always, teachers need an enormous amount of credit. We have teachers in our family. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if we paid them more, they wouldn't need the credit. You wouldn't need the credit. But it's time for us to take a little break. And this is going to be a short break, listeners. So just be with us. And we're going to be right back. If you're just tuning in, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN 88.5, listener-supported radio. And I'm Henry Cuenca, and our guest today is Sarah Clark, a behavioralist. Is that okay for me to say
sure.
that? Sure. Yep. I guess you had mentioned that you had a story of one of your students that was not necessarily a pleasant one, but there was an actual suicide with one of your students. A very tearful situation. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I was not anywhere near him when this suicide happened, and it happened probably 7 years after he was my student, or more. But his family, I know his family, and what I remember about him and what I keep in my mind is we read the Chronicles of Narnia in our class, and his favorite character was Rinpoche the mouse, who's a very heroic character with a scimitar, some sort of a big sword, and Rinpoche gets around on the sea in a coracle, a very primitive round boat, and this student made a coracle out of clay, and I kept it for a long time till it fell apart. But anyway, I certainly don't consider it a success story, and I'm sorry that it happened because he was a cool guy. But the thing is about if I'm going to choose to work with the highest risk kids I can find, then I will need to accept some sorrow with
right,
that.
Certainly.
Because it's like, here's Sarah Clark, and here's a bunch of social, political, economic factors creating things in some little kid. Well, that's only me.
Right,
so I'll do my persistence and do my best, and I won't stop.
Very, very difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. You were born in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And I mentioned in the opening of the show that your childhood was not necessarily a happy one. And I would like for you to tell our listeners just exactly the dynamics that you grew up in.
So my situation was my mother had, I guess, two or three miscarriages, and then she had me. So that was all fine. My father was a research veterinarian. My mother was a good 40s, 50s lady who stayed home and was wifely.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was all fine. And I had a sister who was 11 years older than me. It was said to be adopted, but we've always wondered whether something happened.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so she was there, and I think things went just fine until when I was about 18 months old, my sister was sent off to boarding school, because that's part of life in Pennsylvania. You go to boarding school for high school. And that was probably a big shock, because she was probably the warmest, fuzziest person in the household. The other two were fine, not mean people, but just not quite as physically attentive, probably. And then at two, my father, who worked for the Squibb Pharmaceutical Company doing research with dairy cattle, for some reason died in 48 hours.
That quickly.
Got sick, died. Massive hemorrhaging.
And you were how old at that time?
Two.
Two.
I don't remember any of this. But clearly what happened is I became an attachment disorder kid. So I wasn't beaten, I wasn't molested, I wasn't, you know, but that was enough of a shock that I decided, let's just step back, and humans can't be trusted, obviously, and I will do it my way. So attachment disorder leads to borderline personality disorder when you become an adult. When I was 6 years old, I first recognized how my brain worked. Because when I was 6 years old, they send you off to school, so you have to deal with a lot of people there. So I would say, I see, Ellen does this, oh, I'll do that. And Susie does this, so I'll do that. And I asked myself at the time, why can't you just do whatever you do? Well, the reason was I was not developing normally.
Mm-hmm.
I could only mimic what other people my age did. And that went on and on and on. And I can tell you it's a hard way to live.
What was your relationship with your mother?
Not much. Most children, even if they're mistreated, don't give up on relationship. I had given up. So it was not a comfortable relationship. And again, she was not a mean person, and I thank her. I thank her for, let me say two things. I was an unhappy kid, yes. Anybody who splits from human relationships is not going to be happy. What I had was the natural world, which she allowed me to have. I was out there with that earth and those trees and those bushes, and I had music, and I had poetry, and I had song, and she gave me that too. So those, I was always happy.
Those are pretty astute observations that you endured at a very, very young age, which I would say between 6 and 10 or 11, 12 years old, when these observations or these critiques of yourself, I mean, they're pretty astounding in themselves.
I think those astute observations came later, but all I had at six was this realization that I had to copy. I didn't know if everybody had to do that, but I did wonder. So I guess, okay, I accept it was astute observation.
So essentially, you turned to nature and art
and
to occupy
music,
right?
Music, anything musical, and then. Yeah, I'm going home in May to Pennsylvania, and I won't want to come back because my body will know it's home, and my body will know it's safe.
Well,
and I'll have to tell it, well, I'm sorry, but we now live in California.
For the benefit of our listeners, we do furnish Kleenex for everybody in our room here, including myself. So, Sarah, I see how you stepped into this new realm. What influences? What people influence you? I know you had a relationship with your grandparents that maybe have pulled you in a little bit and spurred you to think about different things. Can you tell us about that?
Well, in my early life, it wasn't actually even grandparents, though I did have my maternal grandmother, I think, was always in pain. She had various physical problems, and she always, you can't see expressions over the radio, but if you could, you'd be scared of hers. Then my other grandma, who fortunately I look like, she was a nicer, softer sort of person.
Like you.
Yeah, like me on a good day. let's see. Anyway, but it was really the great-grandparents who I never knew, but who I heard stories about. And so my father's mother's mother was Caroline Ludeman, and she, the story is too long to tell, but ended up homesteading in St. Paul. And I have a photograph of her, which is incredible because the photograph comes from the 1800s and people didn't take a lot of photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And she is standing in a field and she has on all her long skirts, aprons, and her old sweater, wool sweater with the holes in it. And you can see the barn in the background and she is looking off down the rows. And so she is... I love the land. I love the farming. I love the growing of food. And so she guides me. And she was very strong and she persevered. And she had 12 children and lost none in childbirth. This is incredible for that day. Lost none in childbirth, lost only one in adolescence because that was Freeburg and he was thrown from a horse.
My goodness.
Died. The six girls all became professional women, also unheard of, except my grandma, who married the grocer and moved back to Ashland. Then that was that one. And then on the other side, there's the story that I've told of the farm. And so this is my maternal grandmother's parents. And the farm, everybody's worried about the farms, you know, because the houses are made of wood. They burned sometimes. Well, this couple, my great-grandparents, lost the farm, lost the barn. They lost everything. And the story that I was told is they were out at the sharecropper's house that night. So they had all their kids out there at the sharecropper's house, and they were bedded down, and everybody was bedded down except the dad, and he was pacing around and just lamenting and had no idea how they would ever recoup the loss. And his nice German wife got up out of the bed and confronted him and said, "Well, there's nothing we can do about it right now. So we will go to sleep. We will get a good night's sleep. And in the morning, we will begin." So he laid down in the bed and went to sleep. And in the morning, they began. And the house they built is still there in the midst of
it. It still remains.
Yeah.
What, at an early age, the seed was set to do something with children. Didn't that happen?
Well, the seed was set, I think, in my genes to do something with children, because my cousin, I'll be visiting my cousin's wife, actually, soon out in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. When I would go up to visit her, visit them, they had three girls, and my name, according to the girls, was Cinderella. So, because my name was Sarah Ellen Cinderella. Anyway, and so I just loved that whole thing of being around little kids and playing with little kids and doing this and doing that. And so that, I think, is probably in the DNA somewhere.
Well, I get the sense that you have angelic tendencies.
I know. I have heard you say that, and it's very interesting. I consider myself a miracle. But if you want to put on angel, go ahead. I accept.
Well, an
Thank
angel
you, Henry.
is a person of exemplary conduct or virtue. So I think you fit that description pretty accurately.
Thank you.
So if you could just comment, we have a break coming up. And,
okay.
And if I know that, because of a lack of a father, that you had a fantasy of wanting to have a father. Not that you would order through Sears catalog, but how did that manifest, this yearning, this basic desire of having a father? How did that manifest, manifest?
I thought about it all the time, my entire childhood through adolescence. So it was always in my mind. There was a, it was like the missing piece. And I wish I still had them, because I wrote stories about children with fathers. And I can even remember where they were stored. I wrote profusely. But, you know, I think I really wasn't, it wasn't the father. I mean, I'm sad, you know, that the father was missing. But I think by the time I started writing about it in fourth or fifth grade, and nobody ever read them, it was just me writing to me, I was missing me, because the rest of you were growing up and you were adding layers to your personality and who you were, and I wasn't. And so I was really, I called it a father, but I was really missing me. And I didn't really get me until a long time later. So,
I think, Sarah, that we're going to take a little break right now. And our listeners, you're listening to The Henry Cuenca Show on KKRN Community Support Radio. And we're going to be back in just a moment. Thank you. We're back with our guest, Sarah Clark, and this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Supported Radio. And, of course, I'm Henry Cuenca with our guest, very inspiring guest of Sarah Clark. Sarah, you made a comment just before our break, And it reminded me of a saying of Dag Hammarskjöld. For our listeners, Dag Hammarskjöld was the Secretary General, a diplomat, author, Secretary General of the United Nations. And what he said was, what makes loneliness an anguish is not that I have no one to share my burden, but this, I have only my own burden to bear. That's kind of what you said.
You got it.
A few minutes ago.
You got it. That's it.
That just absolutely speaks volumes of you.
Yeah.
I know I had asked you to say, I said that you're a poet and you say poems. And if you could give us some of your favorite poems.
Sure. And you're just going to have to cut me off when you get tired of it. Okay.
I don't think we'll get tired of it.
Well,
but we have a lot
of
ground to cover yet.
Okay, so I'm going to start here with a poem that I just went to last night as I was thinking about this program. This is not a poem by me. This is a poem about a lady I will be visiting in May in North Carolina. Her name is Ann Deegan. She is a classics professor and a poet, and now 90-something. So I go back and see her every year. I lived with their family when I was in college. She apparently was aware of my distress when I was a young person, because here's their poem about me. It's called Deer Crossing. I see you now, a fawn in face of traffic, frozen deathless at the yellow line. At my horn leap the imagined barricade, stiff-legged to alive. My darling, break out of the yellow labyrinth, the lines that streak your stillness, bound to what fenced wilderness we still may keep between the gangrene highways and the dark.
Beautifully said.
She's a poet.
I had the occasion to be with you when you saw a pond. And I wonder if you could recite the pond poem.
That's right. And he wants me to recite this because he has a pond and he actually fell into it.
With my John Deere, no less.
Oh, dear. Okay. So this is called Daddy Fell Into the Pond. And I think it's by Alfred Noyes. Everyone grumbled. The sky was gray. We had nothing to do and nothing to say. We were nearing the end of a dismal day and there seemed to be nothing beyond. Then Daddy fell into the pond, and everyone's face grew merry and bright, and Timothy danced for sheer delight. Give me the camera, quick, oh, quick, he's crawling out of the duckweed, click. The gardener suddenly slapped his knee and doubled up, shaking silently. The ducks all quacked as if they were daft, and it sounded as if the old drake laughed. Oh, there wasn't a thing that didn't respond when Daddy fell into the pond.
Oh, my goodness. Listeners, this was not read. This was a memorized poem. Beautiful. I did a little bit of research on people that say poems. And I understand that poetry is a powerful form of self-expression.
Oh, yes.
I've read a lot of autobiographies and biographies of folks of prior centuries, and noticed that an awful lot of them read poetry. Mm-hmm. And here I see that you are truly a poet, because I know you have a list of many, many, many poems that you've created. And it is a way, I understand, to express love, to define one's own life, that maybe things that are missing or aspirations that they may have. So poems are really a unique contribution to the existence of people.
Absolutely. And I think that, I just want to jump in here. Writing is a different brain modality than speaking. So not just poetry, but any kind of writing. So, for example, I had years of psychotherapy in my life. I would write and then I would read what I wrote to know what I knew. And I think it's the same with poems. You can write a poem, and then the poet will often read it many times to know what they know, to know what they knew,
well,
to know what they wrote.
That's a little quick for my brain, but I'll
okay.
get it, I'm sure.
Okay, I'm going to be quiet now.
Can you tell us the funeral poem?
You want to hear Goldie's poem? All right.
Tell us about the backup of this
yes,
poem.
Yes, okay. So when I started teaching community day school, I cried every day for the first year. And the second year, I only cried every other day. And then I learned how to do it. So it was still hard, but I stopped crying. So in those days when I actually became a actually functioning, hopefully helpful teacher over there, I had a wonderful student one year. And he was much smarter than I am, which makes it very hard to teach. But anyway, we wrote a lot of poems, and we spent a lot of time in nature. So this poem that Henry is alluding to is called The Day That Goldie Died, and I wrote it when our goldfish died. So it is a funeral poem. The day that Goldie died. Rainy Friday, the day that Goldie died. 7 years she swam so strong and free. First to the top when the food flakes floated down. Mistress of the tank, Goldie. But all living things die. No life under the sky will avoid that end. And this gray day, Goldie died. The toilet? That's no fitting end for a friend like Goldie. This water queen of royal destiny must have a proper burial at sea. We scoop her in a dish, our beloved fish, and step out under the solemn sky, proceeding down the hill. Here once the flowers bloomed in grand array, but now, this day, tight closed, heads bowed, mourn Goldie on her way to the sea.
Can I copyright that?
I can't copyright it, but I'll give you a copy.
It may be obvious, but I'm going to ask you, what is central to your life?
Central to my life? Oh, gosh, Henry. Let's see. What is central to my life?
What's the most important thing to you?
The most important thing to me is my faith. That is probably
Let's talk about that. Tell us more about that.
Well, we can tell the entire story of the change in my life, the great epiphany.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get to that.
Would you like me to go ahead with that,
we can jump into that? Sure.
All right. So here you have this 2-year-old rustling around in an adult body, reaching approximately the age of 50. A mother, not a real good one, because people with attachment disorder and borderline personality disorder don't make wonderful spouses or parents. But there you are. So anyway, I was functioning. So the simple answer to your question is my Christian faith is the thing that is most important to me. So here's the deal. So this is the life-changing experience. So I had this thing. My thought processes were, as Dog Hammarskjöld say, I had that lonely, it was me, and it was me, and it was me, and it was me, and the rest of you guys were somewhere doing something, but it was basically mm-hmm. me. And then I had to manage, but I had to manage you guys to be safe. So truth, there's another really important thing to me, truth. I had to learn about that. So the way I lived was to do what would get the response from you guys that would keep me safe, or any guys, any people in the world. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I lived. Anyway, now I liked being around churches. I grew up in Quaker meeting. And so I at this time, I was, I don't know, 50, I guess. Anyway, I did go to church on Sundays. But I mean, my thought processes were so primitive, I could barely believe in the furniture if I wasn't looking at it. So we're talking very primitive here. So anyway, and I was very stressed because it's very stressed, extremely stressful to live that way. Mm-hmm. Very anxiety provoking. So, and here I was, I had a job, I was a mother, I was a wife. Oh, it was very difficult. And everybody thought I was fine because I looked fine because I was really good at it. So I started this practice. So I would go upstairs before anybody else in the house got awake. I would sit down on the brown couch, which my former husband still owns, and I would pray. Now, of course, I didn't even believe in the furniture, much less God. But anyway, I would pray just because, I don't know, because I felt better if I did. So anyway, and I had two beliefs about religion. One was I was a universalist, and I believed that there probably was a creator, and that feeling came out in many religions. So that's universalism. My other belief was that people had made up religions just to make themselves feel better, like I did. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of those two. So I guess you could say I was an atheist agnostic or whatever, who liked to go to church.
That's an interesting perspective.
I was crazy. That's the thing. So there I am on the couch. So I had this. So I was reading a book slowly. It's in little sections by Thomas Merton called The New Man. He's a Catholic theologian. And I would read a psalm. So I'd sit there and I'd read a psalm and I'd read a little piece of Thomas Merton. And then I had this elevator thing because I was a very creative 2-year-old. So I'd send my little needs up on the elevator and then something would happen and I'd get through the day. Well, that went on. That was pretty nifty. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was fine. I was perfectly satisfied with that. So that went on for months. And I was teaching preschool at the time in MacArthur. Anyway, and so I was up there one morning, and I did my thing, and I read Thomas Merton, and I read a psalm, and I sent the stuff up. And I heard a voice say, "I don't want your problems." Well, I had not manufactured that voice. So I know we're not supposed to have silence on the radio, but I was just, I had nothing to say. And then that same voice said, "I want you."
Oh, my goodness sakes.
This is ridiculous. This was not according to plan. So I said, then I finally said something. And then I started thinking semi-logically. And I thought, well, this is totally preposterous. But if this is God talking to me, then you can't have me because the divine and the human can't be together. And then there were no more voices, so you're spared that. There were no more voices, but the Christian gospel, as though now Christ was saying to me, "Well, that's why I did what I did, Sarah. That's why I did what I did, so we could be together. I could have you." And it was like the story of Jesus, the incarnation, God coming to the earth, living, teaching, dying, resurrecting to save us. It was like it rolled out, but there were no more speaking.
And obviously that was a sudden life-changing event.
Yes, it was. And it would be really nice to say I jumped up and started shouting hallelujah. That was not the case. I got up and went to work wondering what in heaven's name had just happened to me. But nothing changed. And then, starting that day, everything got worse.
God bless
you. Yeah, thank you very much. Anyway,
I think we have to take a little break right now. From KKRN Community Radio. Welcome back. This is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Supported Radio. And you're listening to our guest, Sarah Clark, who has just gone over a profound epiphany. And Sarah, take us from that moment on.
Okay, well, as I said, things got quite a bit worse, and the house of cards that I had built beginning at the age of two began to be deconstructed. So the way I'd always lived gradually couldn't quite live. And remember, this is all in my brain. Everybody thought I was fine, but it was falling apart. And there wasn't a lot new. But what there was this ridiculous trust and faith. I had no reason to trust God. I had no reason to have faith. I had no experience to base it on. It's like it dropped in, you got it, and you're going somewhere. So that there were 2 years of starting to fall apart. Oh, and during that time, what a panacea. It couldn't have been better. I got hired to teach sixth grade. I called it my purgatorial year. Here I was, falling apart, faced with 25 of those demons. So
students, no less.
Yeah, right. Oh, it was. I was miserable. Anyway, so it's a long story, but I entered. In 2 years, two friends came into my life who were to be my supporters, which Lord knows I needed when I got into long-term, heavy-duty, in-depth psychotherapy. Can I read my poem?
Sure.
All right. In a nutshell, what I had to learn to do was trust people. That took, 10 or 12 years. At the very beginning of the process of psychotherapy, I was given a poem, and I can't say I wrote it. It dropped into my head on the MacArthur Road one morning on my way to the fairgrounds. It's called Trust Factor. Now, I don't like gambling, but I have to thank Circus Circus for this poem. Trust Factor. The casino is built like a circus tent. Life is a gamble for most. Put your coins in the slot and maybe. The casino is built like a circus tent. In levels. Upstairs, children gamble for bunnies, stuffed bunnies. We teach them early to gamble. The casino is built like a circus tent in levels. Above the children, trapeze artists swing and fly. Children run to watch. Drop your bunnies. Watch well. No gamble here, but trust, levels of trust. Look up, children. Learn trust. Level one, trust your trapeze, your art. Keep your grasp firm on the bar. Level two, trust your partner. Keep your grasp firm on the wrists. Level three, let go. Trust the one you cannot see, who swings close by. He awaits your release, your spin, your grasp. Look up, children. Learn trust. That started me off 10 years of agonizing, horrible, I was terrible, psychotherapy.
Absolutely beautiful.
In which I learned everything that I use now.
That is such a beautiful scenario. Value is in the doer and not the deed.
Right.
And I think that you exemplify totally and completely.
Thank you. Praise the Lord.
That's Dennis Whaley that wrote that quotation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If we can reflect a little bit, I had meant to recite this quotation a little earlier, but I was so moved by various things that you've been sharing with us. Mm-hmm. And this is by Frederick Douglass.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And he says, it is easier to raise strong children than to repair broken men.
That's true.
And I guess that's the essence of the bowling ball going down the alley and hitting a complete strike mm-hmm. in the virtuous work that you do. And I wonder if you could mm-hmm. comment a little bit and reflect on the essence of what Frederick Douglass said.
Well, it's a reason I don't work with teenagers or adults. Some people say, you know, you had such experience, wouldn't you like to be a psychotherapist? Oh, please spare me. I would never in a million years sit in a little room. The thought is abhorrent. I would get a client like me. And I would say after 2 months, hang it up, forget it. So I know I'm not made for that. I agree with Frederick Douglass, and I don't know how those people who work with big people do it. So that's why I say, give me your tired, your poor 6-year-olds. I'll take those. And they've had 6 years to put those behaviors in place. You give me 6 years to put some insight in or to offer some. I'll do that. But I won't do the big ones. Because, I don't know. Because I like to see something happen. And the big ones, I mean, would you want to... I just take my hat off to my psychotherapists. Because I can't believe they sat there.
Well, another gift.
That's a gift, and I don't have
Absolutely.
It, and I don't want it.
Another gift.
You couldn't pay me enough.
Well, we're reaching the nearer end of our show, and Sarah had, before the show got started, said that she wanted to make some comments, personal comments, here at this time. So this was not originally part of the show, but we gratefully want Sarah to share additional feelings or things that she wants to communicate and leave with our listeners.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, there's a couple of things that have happened in my life recently that made me really value the freedoms that we have in our country and in our community, and the freedom to speak. And I really want to thank Ellen Sugg, who's one of the managers here and also my good neighbor, because I was questioning whether I should really do this, whether what I had to state, what I had to say, especially the Christian conversion experience, was really going to fit on KKRN, and I didn't want to be unfair to them. So I spoke to her about this, and immediately, without any hesitation, she said, "We believe in freedom of religion and freedom of speech." I said, okay, here we go. And then I knew that I could do it. And as I think about that, I am just blessed that KKRN is community radio, that the community will be represented in all its various ways and colors. So I really appreciate that, and I would like to sing in the name of freedom a little song from the civil rights movement. Oh, freedom, oh, freedom, oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. And the next thing I'm really happy about today and in my life in general is community. There was a time when I could only operate as an individual. Now I am blessed with great community, and I appreciate it, and I realize that I can't do anything without it. And my friend Michael, who is a psychologist who I consulted when I considered getting into psychotherapy, which I ultimately did, he said to me many times, you won't do this by yourself, Sarah. You will not do this by yourself. So here's a little song from Pete Seeger. Step by step, the longest march can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly none, singly none. Then by union what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none, singly none. So I thank you to the little community here, to Ellen, Henry, and the KKRN community. Thank you. Bye.
Well, Sarah, there's not much more than I can say, but to thank you for your complete open expressions from your heart about yourself and the tremendous work that you do.
Thank you.
This ends our show. This ends our show. You have been listening to Community Radio, supported KKRN 88.5. We are supported by listeners like you and brought to you by volunteers from the community. Are you ready to support this local community radio station? To become a listener supporter, go to our website, kkrn.org, and click on the donate button or mail a check to P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. Or you can call 530-337-1101. To volunteer at KKRN Community Radio or to learn more about us. Thank you for listening to the Henry Cuenca Talk Show. And we are here in earnest working to make our community and our world a better place. Please tune in to my next show, Tuesday, March 20th at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, where you will meet Bennett Gale, a speaker, a actor, a teacher, a coach, and an amazing human being. Learning the rudiments of his talented gifts at the age 5. Please remember today's quotation: it is easier to raise strong children than to repair broken men. And that was, of course, by Frederick Douglass. Send me an email at kkrn.org, and thank you for listening.